This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. The United States and Russia traded accusations Thursday at the UN Security Council over the recent collapse of the Intermediate-Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. Russia called Thursday's security meeting following the U.S. test of a missile ban for more than 30 years by the 1987 treaty. The deputy Russian ambassador said the August 18th U.S. test soon after the expiration of the treaty proved the U.S. had violated the pact. Since, however, much they might harp today in our meeting on the idea that it was the actions of Russia that undermined the INF treaty, the most recent steps taken by Washington are eloquent evidence to the contrary. The acting U.S. Ambassador Jonathan Cohen countered that Russia's deployment of multiple ground-launched cruise missiles that could hit critical European targets violated the treaty.
These developments by the Russian Federation and China, coupled with their aggressive and coercive behaviors, are key drivers behind a deteriorating security environment. The United States will not and cannot ignore this reality.
Both countries withdrew from the pact August 2nd. Iran displayed what it described as a domestically built long-range mobile surface-to-air missile system on Thursday. That's according to Iranian state media.
State TV released footage on Thursday showing President Hassan Rouhani at the unveiling ceremony for the Bavar 373 system. The announcement comes amid rising tension with the United States. Iran shot down a U.S. surveillance drone in the Gulf with a surface-to-air missile in June, saying it was over its territory. But the U.S. insists the drone was in international airspace. Iran has developed a large domestic arms industry in the face of international sanctions and embargoes. Western analysts say Iran often exaggerates its weapon capabilities, but there are still strong concerns about its long-range ballistic missile program.
That's Megan Revel reporting, and this is VOA News. President Trump is scrapping a plan to cut billions in foreign aid. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports from the White House.
Since taking office, the Trump administration's tried each year to slash foreign affairs spending by up to 30%, with lawmakers on both sides rejecting it each time. The president's tried again and now given up on cutting some $4 billion in aid Congress had already approved. A senior administration official says the president was looking to cut what he saw as wasteful spending. Lawmakers disagreed. Sagar Magani at the White House.
President Trump and the other G7 leaders are focusing on the world economy when they open their annual summit this weekend. AP correspondent Mike Rossi.
When President Donald Trump and other leaders of the world's most industrialized nations open their annual G7 summit in France this weekend, they'll be discussing the global economy at President Trump's request. White House economic advisor Larry Kudlow.
We think it's high time that we had a good group discussion of the allies regarding how to promote economic growth and prosperity.
Globally, economic growth has slowed. Germany, the biggest economy in Europe, is showing economic weakness, and China, which has the world's second-largest economy, is going through a pronounced slowdown. Mike Gracia, Washington.
A three-year investigation that began with one victim and a single bank account results in the breakup of an international online fraud conspiracy. AP correspondent Tim McGuire.
Who can forget the famous Nigerian prince scam?
Los Angeles-based U.S. Attorney Nick Hanna says things have changed a lot since then, as 80 people are charged with taking part in a multi-million-dollar online fraud scheme that has its roots in Nigeria. Hanna says the scammers stole money from businesses, the elderly, and the lovelorn.
Victims think they are developing a dating relationship, when in fact they're just being tricked into sending money to the fraudsters.
A number of people have been arrested. Others are fugitives in the U.S., while most of the rest are thought to be in Nigeria. Authorities are hoping to extradite them to the U.S. to face charges. I'm Tim McGuire.
A United Nations spokesperson said on Thursday that the organization is very concerned about the most recent forest fires in the Amazon. Speaking in New York, Stephane Dujarric said that all forests were essential for the health of the entire world.
We're very concerned about these fires, both, I think, for the immediate damage that they're causing, and also because sustaining forests is crucial in our fight against climate change.
And the Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro said on Thursday that the government lacks the resources to fight the fires. In a speech broadcast live on Facebook, he said the government is investigating. He also said he never claimed non-governmental organizations were starting the fires. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, August 23rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. A South African court says displaying the country's apartheid-era flag is a hate speech.
Any display of the old flag constitutes a hate speech in terms of Section 10(1) of the Equality Act. B, unfair discrimination on the basis of race.
The regional bloc IGAD urges South Sudan's president to speed up implementation of the peace agreement. The Cameroonian city of Bamenda prepares for a government lockdown as a Catholic bishop appeals for dialogue. A Gabonese judge is suspended for approving an opposition request for an independent medical examination of President Ali Bongo. And the expectation of a malaria-free world remains a distant dream.
We need a re-energized research and development effort to develop the knowledge base, the strategies, and the tools that will allow us to accelerate our road to eradication.
Pedro Alonso is the director of the World Health Organization Global Malaria Program, and a Senegalese activist group celebrates the release of its leaders from detention. Those stories plus Samse O'Malley's sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. South Africa's Equality Court has ruled it is illegal to wantonly display the apartheid-era flag after a case that invoked a national discussion about freedom and expression in the Rainbow Nation. Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
It was never, its critics say, just a flag. For 66 years, through the entirety of the hated, hateful apartheid system, an orange, white, and blue banner symbolized South Africa. It was replaced by a multicolored flag at the beginning of democracy in 1994. These days, the old flag is closely tied to white nationalist groups and can be seen, occasionally, displayed in venues patronized by white nationalists. Never again. In a firm judgment this week, Equality Court Judge Phineas Mojapelo ruled against what he called gratuitous display of the flag, saying it amounted to hate speech, which is illegal.
Any display of the old flag constitutes a hate speech in terms of Section 10(1) of the Equality Act, B, unfair discrimination on the basis of race in terms of Section 7 of the Equality Act, C, harassment in terms of Section 11 of the Equality Act. There is no order as to costs. I hand down the judgment.
In his ruling, he noted that the flag could be displayed in cases that serve the public interest, like artistic, educational, or similar settings. The ruling African National Congress hailed the decision as a victory, not just for us, but for all South Africans, and compared it to another controversial symbol, the Nazi swastika, which is illegal to display in Germany. The case was brought by the Nelson Mandela Foundation, which argued that the display of the flag symbolizes nostalgia for horrific atrocities committed under the flag. Ernst Rutz, the group's head of policy and action, stressed that Afroforum actually discourages its members from displaying the old flag, but says that South Africans should have a legal right to express their beliefs freely. He made that point himself right after the judgment by displaying the flag before his 49,000 Twitter followers and asking, "Did I just commit hate speech?" That provoked hundreds of angry responses from both supporters and detractors, which, he says, underscores the point. In a phone call on Thursday, Hatang told VOA that the Mandela Foundation would file hate speech charges against Rutz for his tweet. And so, the sun is set on a symbol that, for many South Africans, provokes a strong response. As the court announced its ruling Wednesday, crowds of black supporters waved the multicolored flag. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Civil society activists and at least one South Sudanese analyst say the regional bloc intergovernmental authority on development, IGAD, must do more to push the parties to implement the revitalized peace agreement. IGAD issued a communique Wednesday following consultations with the parties in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. Wake Simon Wudu has more from Juba.
The IGAD communique calls for regional heads of state to encourage President Salva Kiir to disburse the balance of $100 million he pledged for the implementation of the peace deal. It also recommends that IGAD heads of state convene a face-to-face meeting of the top leadership of the parties to resolve outstanding issues, including the number of states and remaining security arrangements. The regional body also calls called on IGAD member heads of state and the South Sudan government to halt a summit in mid-September 2019 to decide on the status of rebel leader Riek Machar. Professor Abraham Kualinyon says the communique should have been stronger in its language on urging the parties to implement the peace deal ahead of the November 12th deadline.
It doesn't really give pressure to the parties to the extent that the parties are seriously coming back to their destination without having a real action point that they are coming to do, because the communique is only trying to exhort them to be able to continue with their previous status quo.
Kual says South Sudanese expected the consultative meeting in Addis Ababa to resolve the dispute over the number of states and the status of Riek Machar, whose movement remains restricted. Kenyi Yasin Abdallah, executive director of the Juba-based Advocates for Human Rights Democracy, agrees.
Though we shall come with the result that the number of states is decided by IGAD to be this number or this number. 10 states to the previous one, or this is what we expecting. Also, our expectation is that we need to see that the IGAD will also talk about releasing Dr. Riek Machar from detention, because he's one of the principal signatories of the agreement. Without releasing him would mean the peace is still in doubt on the side of the rebel.
A week ago, a coalition of South Sudanese civil society organizations launched a 90-day countdown to the November deadline for forming the unity government. The activists say today are worried that with less than 3 months to go before the end of the pre-transitional period, the parties will likely not be ready to form a unity government by the November deadline. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
A Cameroonian Catholic priest is calling for a dialogue between the government and separatists to resolve the ongoing crisis in Cameroon's English-speaking regions. Monsignor George Nkuo, Bishop of Kumbo Diocese, says there needs to be a solution to the crisis to end the suffering of those caught in the crossfire. His remarks follow reports of government preparations to lock down Bamenda, an English-speaking city, following recent violence there. There was a lockdown Wednesday after a military court sentenced separatist leader Sisiku Ayuktabe and 9 others to life imprisonment. Monsignor George Nkuo spoke with viewers Peter Clotte.
As far as I know, the city of Bamenda was in a lockdown yesterday because there were gunshots and people who were into their businesses ran back home. But today I think there's a normal day. People are going about their businesses and today is all right. But I think there is a frustrating situation where we say that there are plans for a lockdown. Some may say it's beginning on Monday, some may say it's beginning on the 2nd. So we are not sure exactly. There's confusion about dates.
So with the people you've interacted with since you got to Bamenda, the parishioners, what are their concerns about this anticipated plan by the government to try to resolve what some people see as tension and the lockdown the previous day?
If there are lockdowns, I think there are two basic reasons why there's a lockdown. First one is that those who are envisaging a lockdown, they are very clear they don't want resumption of school. They're totally against resumption of school, which is unfortunate. And that would be the first reason. The second reason would be the recent sentence of their so-called Amazonian leaders who have been sentenced to life jail, life imprisonment.
So, Monsignor, one thing a lot of English-speaking Cameroonians and parishioners have said is that they wonder why it appears the government seems to be unwilling to negotiate without preconditions or hold dialogue with the so-called separatists to try to resolve this impasse, because a lot of people have been caught in the crossfire. So as a bishop, what is your take on this, and why do you think attempts by the Catholic Church calling on both sides to have a dialogue to resolve this impasse seems or appears not to be heard by both sides?
I like to talk like a pastor. I am not a politician, and I look at it from a pastoral point of view. I think there is a conflict, and it's important for the parties who are in conflict to sit back and put the issues at table and sit across the table and address them up front in a transparent and in a frank manner. If the Amazonians want separation, there's no way that any government would want to divide its country. You can see the complexity and the dilemma in which we find ourselves. We think whatever it is, if you say no conditions, put the point that in a dialogue, you put the point at table, it's a give and take.
Monsignor George Nkuo is the Bishop of Kumba Diocese in Cameroon. He spoke with viewers Peter Clotty from Bamenda. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, August 23rd. Daybreak Africa time, 15 minutes past the hour. An appeals court judge in Gabon, Paulette Ayo Mba Akoli, has reportedly been suspended for approving an opposition request for a medical examination of President Ali Bongo. Mr. Bongo suffered a stroke in October last year while attending a conference in Saudi Arabia. He spent 5 months in Morocco recovering, but since his return to Gabon in March this year, he has not made a live speech or spoken before the general public. The opposition went to court to demand a neutral and independent medical examination to determine his fitness. A lower court dismissed the case in May, saying only the two houses of parliament or the constitutional court had the power to determine the fitness of the president. Ibrahim Akane is a Senegalese lawyer and human rights activist.
I think this is part of the kind of intrigue that is still going on in Gabon. We all know that the president has health problem in Saudi Arabia. He was transferred to Morocco. He stayed there for many months and then after came back at home and nobody saw him. Some people in the opposition decided to file a case before the courts just to know if the president is fit for exercising his power.
It seems to me the other judges are interpreting the ruling to mean that the court of cessation decision has no value. So it seems to me other judges have a concern the way she handled it.
You know, I have to tell you, this is not the first time that this kind of issue happens. If you recall, a few years ago, it was almost the same kind of problem that Alassane Dramane Ouattara faced in Cote d'Ivoire about his nationality. All the court dismissed the possibility for Ouattara to get ID card. And he went in a village in the central part of the country, applied for it, and got it from a judge. And that judge had to leave the country because this was not only a legal issue, it was a political issue. In my view, this is the same kind of problem that Gabon is facing at the moment. Nobody said that the complaint filed by two leaders of the opposition was illegal. Nobody. They only said that the judge didn't have the power to order a check for the president. Why? Because simply people believe that that kind of action needs only to be taken at the highest level, which is not true because nobody said and nobody gave evidence that the tribunal that was said of the matter was not competent to deal with the issue. And for somebody who knows how the legal system functions in Gabon, we all know that the judiciary is not very independent at the highest level.
So I'm wondering what happens now, because the opposition had wanted this independent medical examination to assess the state of health of President Bongo. So what happened now? What do they do now?
Well, it's a kind of statu quo because everybody who watched the TV the other day saw a person who cannot even walk, saw a person who cannot even talk. So how can a president of a republic like Gabon will be accepted with such kind of medical condition? It's a problem. So I think the action taken by the opposition is just to try to test the capacity of the legal system to do something. When you look at it also in a very practical level, nothing is working in Gabon at the moment.
Ibrahim Kani is a Senegalese lawyer and human rights activist. He was speaking with us from Dakar. The Front for an Anti-Imperialism and Pan-African Revolution, known by its French acronym FRAB, celebrated the recent release of one of its leaders this week. The group is in the spotlight in Senegal, where it is fighting for a new currency, as well as the exit of multinational corporations in the country. Landon Santiani, one of the group's spokesperson, spoke to Ricky Stryak about their goals.
It's movement who fight for rights of our community, who fight for against oppression, against imperialism, as you know. And in Senegal, we start so many campaigns like France Release or France Out for monetary sovereignty, It is a fight that was destined for the Franc CFA.
There is a movement for some West African countries to move away from the Franc CFA and toward a new currency. You guys support that, correct?
Yeah. It is a fight against the system of monetary prediction. That's why you call this campaign France Dégage, France Out. As you know, it is France that makes our currency. It is she who guarantees our currency. Even in the board of director of our banks, it is France who has the last word. And also, we have also the campaign such as the Auchan Dégage, Carrefour Dégage, to fight against the multinational and their settlements in our country.
And why do you think this fight is important? Why would you prefer that multinationals weren't in Senegal?
Really, we all know that it's a big problem for our people getting job in our country. So that's why we see so many people taking the fear to go, going to Europe. And we just want to give them the opportunity. We just want to give them this faith and also this volunteer to stay here and build our future in our country. We just want to give them the courage and give them the opportunity to believe ourselves, to build our own future in this continent.
But what if someone says, for instance, that Auchan provides jobs for these people? And why would you want them to leave?
Auchan is a producer, a seller, and also grocers, something like that. Here in our country, we can see so many part of job when Auchan implant his shop in our country, because he will block so many jobs in our continent.
Landon Siani Tiane is a spokesperson for the Front for an Anti-Imperialism and Pan-African Revolution. We're speaking to Ricky Stryer from Dakar. A 3-year study by 13 leading malaria and public health experts finds that malaria eradication is possible, but that it will take new tools, political commitment, and lots of money to achieve. Lisa Schlein reports from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
The concept of malaria eradication is not new. It has been around since the mid-1950s, when the World Health Organization launched its first global malaria eradication plan. Though that and subsequent efforts have failed to rid the world of the deadly, debilitating disease, experts say malaria eradication is feasible. They say there is no biological barrier to its elimination. The director of the WHO's Global Malaria Program, Pedro Alonso, says achieving that goal would involve improving primary health care and access to services, and better use of data and surveillance systems. But the key to eradicating malaria, he says, is accelerated research and development of new tools.
We need a re-energized research and development effort to develop the knowledge base, the strategies and the tools, be these vector control tools, drugs, improved vaccines or other technologies that will allow us to walk the last mile or even accelerate our road to eradication.
Global malaria infection and death rates have remained virtually unchanged since 2015. The World Health Organization reports every year some 200 million people are infected with malaria and about 400,000 die. It says more than 90% of those deaths occur in sub-Saharan Africa. Children are the biggest victims. Health experts say eradicating malaria would both save lives and boost economies, but that takes political commitment and money. The WHO estimates the cost of scaling up current malaria intervention until 2030 at $34 billion. The agency says the return on that investment would be huge. It says the strategy the money buys would save 4 million lives over the next 11 years and would prevent 2 billion people from being infected with malaria. The economic gain, it says, would be roughly $283 billion in total gross domestic product. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa's portion. Here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you, James. We begin the sport in South Africa, where South Africa Football Association, SAFA, will this weekend launch the first Women's National Football League in Southern Africa, but there is no clarity on prize money for the champions and monthly grants. The historic Women's National League will see 12 teams across the country compete in a round-robin system. SAFA President Danny Jordan confirmed none of the matches will be televised for now, but said the association is engaging a number of broadcasters.
We have to strengthen the clubs now. The clubs are basically clubs from grassroots football, amateur clubs, and a whole range of measures must be taken to strengthen those clubs to be able to compete at a national level.
According to SAFA Vice President Ria Ledwaba, all the 12 teams will be accommodated and be assisted financially throughout the season.
With or without a sponsor, we are establishing this league. And when it is established, we'll work around the clock to make sure that this league is sustainable.
And now to Kenya, where Football Kenya Federation President Nick Madwawa has defended the latest decision to appoint Francis Kimanzi as the head coach of the national team Harambee Stars. FKF President maintains it was the right time to bring in a local coach for the national team following the exit of Sebastian McNee.
We have thought about it, discussed with him, and we think that he's best placed now in Kenyan history to drive this team forward after his experience being with the national team.
For his part, the newly appointed coach, Francis Kimanzi, says he will be seeking to build on the foundation left by departed Frenchman Sebastian McNee.
It's difficult sometimes to satisfy everyone around the beautiful game, but we'll try. We'll try most of the time, you know, in selection, in monitoring and guiding the players. We'll try our level best, but I can tell you it will never be easy.
And on a rather sad note, former Ghana international Junior Agogo has passed away at the age of 40. The former Nottingham Forest player has been battling stroke since 2015 after he retired from football. He had won 26 caps for Ghana and was a country star at the 2008 African Cup of Nations. Here's how some fans reacted to the news of the death of the Ghanaian former football star.
And he was one of the players who was very strong.
He's the only Black Stars player I have a crush on.
He was a fantastic player.
Girls were crazy about him.
I learned he's JJ's nephew.
I had a crush on him.
He's very strong and can take on the defenders.
Anytime he came onto the pitch, the girls were all excited.
And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. We look forward to your report again on Monday morning. And briefly before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Civil society activists and at least one South Sudanese analyst say the regional bloc Intergovernmental Authority on Development, IGAD, must do more to push the parties to implement the revitalized peace agreement. IGAD issued a communique Wednesday following consultations with the parties in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. A Cameroonian Catholic priest is calling for dialogue between the government and separatists to resolve the ongoing crisis in Cameroon's English-speaking regions. Monsignor George Nkuo, Bishop of Koumba Diocese, said there needs to be a solution to the crisis to end the suffering of those caught in the crossfire. That's it for this Friday, August 23rd edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson Omale, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good weekend.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience.